Flashback? Flashback?
Rufio! Rufio!
Flashbacks.
All day I've had this strong desire raging from within. You can say that my heart's on fire.
Somewhere between.
Keep your hands on where I can see them, man.
Hey, it's 21st century, man. I don't know what I can do.
Flashbacks.
You are a sick individual and you need to be put out of your misery.
Flashback? Flashback?
Well, everybody out there in podcast land, and welcome to another episode of the Front Row Network's Flashbacks, the series where we get all nostalgia-like and revisit our favorite movies from the past as we sit and in our quarantine times. Tonight is a very special night because we've got two guests. One is a frequent front row front row collaborator, but tonight he is given a very special mantle. Mr. Jay Hoffman is going to be given the rank of co-host here at Flashback. Welcome, Jay.
How's it going? Thank you.
Awesome, awesome. Thank you for accepting that mantle. Appreciate it. Next up, we have a newbie to the Front Row Network, and it's his first ever podcast, Mr. Ben Weir. Ben, how you doing?
Doing well. Thanks for having me.
No problem. No problem. Ben, I know you personally. We've been friends for, 12 years, more than that. I know that you are an action junkie, and that kind of relates to what we're talking to tonight, our focus for our flashback. But per Front Row tradition, we need to know what your favorite movie is and why.
Sure. Well, I thought it was interesting when you invited me on to discuss it, in particular Mad Max, because I've always been enthused by post-apocalyptic movies, you know, just the way that people dress, the way they act, the way they interact. That was always something that, you know, I was drawn to for entertainment purposes, because one of my favorite movies is Waterworld. I don't care what anybody has to say, you know. A, Kevin Costner is Kevin Costner. I've been to his restaurant in the Dakotas. Excellent. Makes a great spinach artichoke dip. Got the recipe. Two, he's got webbed feet and he can breathe through his ears. So, and, you know, Dennis Hopper, guy's already, you know, may he rest in peace. You know, the guy's character anyway. Put the two of them together on, I think it was, what was that oil tanker that went down, the Exxon Valdez?
Yep.
I think that was the Valdez oil tanker that they were like, anyway, it's got depth. So, yeah.
That sounds like a guilty pleasure episode for our host, Lou Hare. Well, tonight for Flashback, we are going to do a movie that's kind of setting a tone with what's going on in the world and how people are reacting to the current pandemic. You see memes of people dressed in weird costumes, and we're going to get to that a little later. But if you're sitting in a watching a movie and you all of a sudden are watching a scene where someone is given the opportunity to be chained to something or saw off their own leg, like in the movie Saw, or if you're watching the Fast and Furious and you see crazy car chases and you flash back to a particular movie in time, we are flashing back tonight to Mad Max, a movie that has heavy influence on a lot of action-packed movies that came after. But Mad Max, released in March of 1980 in the United States, but it was actually made and released in 1979 in its native country of Australia, where it was shot. The movie was made for $350,000 to go on and make $100 million. This movie, Mad Max, holds the Guinness Book of World Records for the biggest budget to profit ratio until 1999, when the Blair Witch Project unseats it. This movie is a classic. It has defined the action genre. It is a story of a man slowly sinking into the depths of craziness. I can't wait to dive in it with you two. So let's go and just dive right in. Jay, first memories of watching Mad Max.
My first memories are definitely from the second and third one, far more than this one. We were kind of talking before we started recording. very into Road Warrior, very into Thunderdome. And then in high school, is when I really started discovering movies and learning that there was a first Mad Max that I was not even aware about, is when I, watched it. And oddly enough, by seeing the sequels before seeing that one, I actually think it made it more impactful because I just rewatched it last night, and this movie and its dystopian future is very, very subtle. And Road Warrior and Thunderdome are not subtle. So it's super cool to see how it's a world that's kind of teetering on the edge of a dystopian future. It's kind of there already, but it's not full blown. So it's really cool to see where that world tipped over the edge. And like you said, with all the stuff going on with the coronavirus and all that stuff, we're not there. We're not in that type of world. But it is really interesting to see the different reactions people are having to the stay home orders and things like that. So I think this is like a great movie for us to flashback to.
Awesome. Thanks, Jay. Ben, what are your first memories about watching Mad Max?
Somewhat similar to Jay. I'd known about Road Warrior and I'd known about Thunderdome, and I grew up, you know, Saturday morning TV, watching TNT, whatever, you know, a lot of Total Recall or whatever else they'd play on a constant loop. So I think I was probably 13 or 14, maybe a little bit older when I first saw the original Mad Max. And I wasn't impressed. I'm like, this is slow. This is low budget. You know, as a young teenager, you know, this didn't do it for me. And I rewatched it recently for this episode and, you know, yeah, it set the tone because George Miller being involved in all the different series, the whole series, it really sets the stage. And for those that haven't seen the original series but have only seen Fury Road, well, if you want to have depth, go back and watch everything from the beginning because it's going to give you context. Because Fury Road has so much noise and culture and color. But you're going to enjoy it so much more if you go back and go from A to B to C and then go there. So, you know, as a younger person, I'm like, garbage. But no, now that I've seen the other ones, I'm a little bit older. I really dig it.
Awesome, Ben. Thank you. You know, and I was sitting there talking to Jay before this. Do you guys remember like Mad Weekends where they would show the Mad Max movies? And I can't remember if they showed Mad Max. And I can't remember just because, you know, it was so long ago. I do remember Thunderdome. You know, I do remember Road Warrior and the guy with the crazy hockey mask. What was his name? Humungo?
Humongous.
Humongous. You know, but I can't remember.
Such great names.
Right? I can't remember if it was on TV, but I do remember not too long ago when Shout Factory acquired it and I revisited it and I was like, man, this movie is fantastic. Ben, I might be in the same lines of maybe got it at the video store when I was younger, but I don't think it made an impact because it was so low budget. Yeah. And just loving the craziness that is Thunderdome, but still liking the series. But now as I'm older, I'm definitely revisiting, you know, it definitely is a very unique film. And that is why it is the topic of our discussion tonight. So let's just break down the plot. Let's just call it what it is. So this is a movie that is, you know, this was filmed in 1979 and the movie says this takes place a couple years later. Well, here we are in 2020 and nothing like we see in Mad Max series has come to fruition, but it's almost pure lawlessness. You've got cops that are patrolling a highway that is just very dangerous. At the start, we see a sign that says 57 deaths in a month. So that kind of sets it up without telling us that we are about to be taken on a wild ride, being very subtle too. But the movie starts off with Knight Rider. Jay, you mentioned funny names. Knight Rider, stealing a car and just going crazy. Let's break that down. Who wants to talk first? Jay, you want to take it?
Yeah, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Because I love that scene just because he just keeps screaming into the radio.
Isn't he singing AC/DC too?
He may have been. I just kept yelling, I am the Knight Rider and I'm a suicide sex machine and just all this crazy stuff. But my favorite part, you know, he makes his way through all these different peace officers, police officers that they have trying to get him to stop and get him off the road before he kills somebody. And then all of a sudden he gets through everybody, and then it's Max who's up. And Max doesn't chase him.
I'm on.
Max goes full on.
Doing a podcast.
Chicken.
Mom.
Goes full on chicken with him. And all of a sudden the suicide machine turns into a real chicken. And that scene was pretty powerful for me. And the thing is that Max was willing to play chicken and risk his life, knowing full well he had a wife and child at home. I think that gives you a glimpse very early on that even though he is a family man, he's got a couple wires that are a little looser than everybody else in the movie.
Yeah, and it is just crazy because you've got two cars that are chasing him, and then you've got Goose on his motorcycle. We find out Goose is Max's like go-to partner. But it ends up being Mad Max that finally reins him in. And when I say rein him in, destroys him by driving into it, you know, just giving speed. It's just crazy, the car accident. So, I mean, that just leads to now we have a target. Mad Max caught the Knight Rider. He killed the Knight Rider because the Knight Rider was crazy driving in explosions. But now the Toe Cutter Gang, led by Toe Cutter, played by Hugh Keyes Byrne. This guy is fantastic. We'll get to him later. But they now want Mad Max. So they go to this town, and this is a biker gang. Like biker gang, you name it, it's there. It's just all sorts of crazy. These guys are dancing in the street. It's nuts. But they track down a car. They brutalize a woman. They make a guy run away. They destroy the car with a meat cleaver? Let's talk about how the movie goes from there. Ben, go ahead. You want to take that part?
Yeah, so I just want to add on all the extra characters, all the extra just weirdos that are in these George Miller movies. Because if you just had Mad Max and, you know, Tina Turner, or Mad Max and, you know, I'm trying to remember the guy's name from Fury Road.
Immortan Joe,
you know, okay, there's two people. All the noise, all the crazy extra characters that are going on just provide so much entertainment and just depth to the movie. That's what I get out of it. That's what I enjoy. And you see that in the beginning with Mad Max. You know, it builds up in Road Warrior, Thunderdome, Fury Road, but there's just so much else going on. And when I was rewatching Mad Max, all the other just ridiculous guys in the biker gang itself that you mentioned, there was a guy just crawling on a roof with super loud sunglasses, acting like he was a cat before they tried to abscond with Max's wife at a seaside resort. I mean, who thinks of this stuff? I mean, you have to stop and if I was new to the genre, new to the series, my opinion, I'd say start from the beginning. You know,
yeah.
Put a pot of coffee on, start with Mad Max, just enjoy it, and then go to the next one and the next one. Because there's things in Furiosa, or not Furiosa, but Fury Road, that you're not going to appreciate unless you've seen the original movies.
Yeah.
But it sets a tone for everything else. So he really has it set in a way that it builds on top of every movie and the subsequent film.
Yeah. So from here, I mean, you know, we really start to see Mad Max and his character development start to go down, or he's starting to go crazy because he wants to retire at this point. It's already mentioned at this point. But Goose, ever since this targeting of this couple on the road and their car was destroyed, the woman was brutalized, the guy ran off crazy. You know, Goose wanted justice. And one of Toe Cutter's, I want to say lieutenants, you've got Bubba and Johnny Boy. Johnny Boy, who's probably tripped out on who knows what drug, is just going crazy. So Goose takes him in, and he wants him tried, and there's no trial. And so, you know, Goose thinks that he has to go out and make something, and he picks a fight. What happens next, Jay?
I don't know.
Well, this is where we get a lot of the violence, because
they take, when they take out Goose, he doesn't get taken out lightly.
The gang goes after Goose, and they go ahead, Jay.
When they do get to Goose, he becomes a Kentucky Fried Goose by the end. they burn him to a pulp, but he lives. And you don't see it, but you see him in the hospital. Just his hand, not him. He's all carried, covered up. And then when Max goes in to see him, his hand pops out and it's just charred. And then Max peeks behind the curtain, and you know, they don't show it. You know, they let your imagination, George Miller, let your imagination do the work. But the shocked look on Max's face told you all that you need to. It was very disturbing how they took out Goose, and it had a lasting impact on Max. And then he, you know, that was it for him. Get his family out of Dodge.
Yeah, he wants out. You know, and you know, Goose was mad because Cutter was able to trick the system and get Johnny Boy without a trial. So he went after him. But the best part about this scene is, and I think it really dives into what we'll talk about when we talk about likes or dislikes. Toe Cutter's the character of Toe Cutter is holding Johnny Boy, and he's making him light the match and cause this accident. And Johnny Boy's like showing remorse, like he's like, "I've had my fun." But it just shows the level of crazy that Toe Cutter is. It's a very unique scene, but we'll get to that later. So, you know, Mad Max or Mac Rockinowski, he's ready to retire. He's done. He doesn't want what happened to Goose. He does not want that to happen to him. So he resigns. His chief, Fifi, again with the names, Fifi's like, "No, we need heroes." And I'm going to talk about that later. That's one of my favorite scenes. It's what I like. Because it really sets the tone for the rest of the series. But Fifi's like, "No, you know, go take a vacation." So he takes a vacation. You know, he's living his life with his family. You know, he needs to get his car fixed. And so he sends his wife to get ice cream. And she has a run-in with what Ben called the cat gang, you know, someone on a roof. And there's Cutter, Toe Cutter. And he's trying to coax the wife. And she gets away. She throws the ice cream in the face, kicks him in the area that doesn't shine, and gets away. That's where things get crazy. Ben, you want to lead us on the very end of the movie? What is the final straw that sends Max down the spiral to where he embodies Mad Max? Ben, you want to spoil the end of the movie?
I will and I won't. So one of the reasons I appreciated going back and watching the first George Miller movie of the series was that it really kind of highlighted that, hey, this is the onset of the breakdown.
Yep.
You know, all current geopolitical, you know, pandemic stuff aside, it shows that everything's beginning to break down. So society and the infrastructure and emergency services are at a threshold where they can't keep up. They can't sustain. They can't do what they need to do to keep people safe. So all that being said, when Max's wife is assaulted, she escapes. She's fine. They go to a seaside resort. Well, the gang catches up, and bad things happen. And Max ends up, who probably, you know, from Goose and everything else that he's had to deal with, may or may not have some post-traumatic stress issues, which exacerbate the situation. And he's coming back from his vacation, which was rudely interrupted, to say the least, puts the uniform back on and seeks retribution on what happens to his family. So I'm not going to spoil anything for anybody, but
this is the spoiler zone. You got to spoil it. Cause if you don't, I will. We spoil things here.
That's your wheelhouse, not mine, but he'll put the uniform back on and he goes after him. He gets his souped up. So the vehicle that, and I'm not a big car guy, but the vehicle that makes its appearance in several of the movies is the Interceptor, which is the Australian version of
police car,
you know, a V8, you know, Impala that's souped up that can go after anything, muscle car, what doesn't matter. That's nitro injected and, you know, it's got the bells and whistles and you can hear, you can hear the sounds kick in when it, he presses the lever and, you know, as Vin Diesel would say, too early, except it's not when it's Max. And he gets after the gang and he finishes them off, but that's all I'll say about that.
All right. Well, I got to spoil it. Cause we do, but we also say spoiler alerts because we break down movies and this is what, you know, in order to understand a character, you have to understand what happens, but Mad Max's wife and the son, another great name, Sprague, mother and son ran down in the road, literally ran down in the road. They're running away. They escaped when the gang infiltrated the seaside resort, but run down. Like, that's a really powerful moment in the movie because to see Max run after them, it's just so heart-wrenching. It's a really key scene in the film. We have no idea what happens in this film. In later films, we find out that they both do perish. But in this film, it's kind of left ambiguous as the wife's fate. The son, they say, dead on arrival. But the wife, we have no idea. But later on, we find out that she does perish. So Max gets upset. Like Ben said, he goes and gets the interceptor, and he tracks down the gang. He disposes the rest of the gang, and then he goes after the last two, Toe Cutter and his right-hand man, Bubba. Bubba is, Bubba gets shot, right? Bubba is about to run over Mad Max and gets blown away with a shotgun. Cutter, gets in a high-speed chase. He's driving, and he literally gets leveled by a semi. But then we have the last bit of revenge, and it's kind of left ambiguous again. But this is the reference I made earlier with Saw. Mad Max catches up with Johnny. Johnny is the guy who lit the match that incinerated Goose, and he literally handcuffs him to a car while improvising an explosive device and says you can either blow up in 10 minutes or you can cut through your ankle in 5 and get away. And we don't know what happens. We do see an explosion, but that's it. And that is literally how the movie ends. I think it's a great ending. That's the movie wrapped in a nutshell, and it really paves the way for the rest of the series. Jay, you want to add anything else?
Yeah, just that scene where his wife and child get ran down. Just prior to that, I think it's her mother that they're with?
I believe so.
I don't think they explicitly say, but she's the one. She takes a gun and shoves it in the face of the bikers, threatens them. She's taking shots at them as they're coming to run them down. She doesn't hit them, but she's taking shots. That really seemed like a reference that came back in Fury Road with the I don't remember what the ladies that were. Yeah, those ladies there hiding in the middle of the desert.
Yeah, the mothers.
It just felt very tied into that. And I don't know if that was – I'm sure it was intentional. It just seemed very – instantly had a flash of those women when she was kind of standing up and fighting.
I noticed that, yeah.
Fighting the gang. But, no, the ending of this movie has always been one of my favorite endings to any movie ever. the ambiguity, the awesomeness of it. And he doesn't say blow up in 10 minutes. He says you can cut through the galvanized steel of the handcuffs in 10 minutes and blow up, or, which it's just,
put your foot in 5.
Yeah. You're just like, holy, it goes from 0 to 100. And that the whole montage sequence of him just chasing down the gang, you really, really get to see how capable George Miller is at directing action. For his directorial debut, scene shot, you know, in 1979, these freaking car chases stand up pretty darn well. And I think, as we've seen with all the other installments, I think, in my opinion, I would say unequivocally that George Miller is the greatest action director that's ever lived. It's not even a question to me. He just shoots action sequences and chases like no one else. And you really get to see glimpses of, you know, it's a little dated just because he himself has made such better things.
Right.
But you really go, wow, this was shot when? Holy, this stands up really well.
41 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, they just, and there's one of the scenes where he's using that, you know, that real world action, you know, no special effects or anything, where one of the biker gangs goes down and then a motorcycle comes crashing and smashes him in the head. That's real. That dude got smashed in the head while tumbling down the road by a motorcycle. I was watching it and my wife was kind of falling asleep watching it. And I looked at her and I go, oh, that was real. That was real. That dude just got smashed in the head with a motorcycle. But I'm just rambling on and on, but there's just some of those, that sequence that you see it so much in the future installments, how good he is at shooting action.
Well, this is a great place to go into our next segue. So now we're going to talk about what we like, about the movie. So everybody's going to have a chance to talk. And then, you know, if we want to include something, what somebody said, Ben, do you want to add anything about the plot of the film before we dive in? I know you're not a spoiler, but
mostly
spoil.
I mean, he summed it up pretty well. I just like going back, having seen it years ago, seeing all the sequels and going back and watching it, I just appreciated, I think I had to be older to kind of get into it, you know, having more of a taste for older, low budget movies. I think that was a big thing for me. But in terms of, you know, my affinity for post-apocalyptic movies, watching the original, knowing George Miller was involved in all the projects, that's cool. But the other thing is it sets the tone because there's a timeline, right? And the original Mad Max is at the beginning of the end of, you know, civilized, the Western world.
And we'll talk about that.
Yeah. So the progression starts there, whether it's society breakdown, his own descent into madness, it all starts there. So if everybody's, you know, got a lot of time on their hands right now, start at the very beginning, which is the first film. Other than that, what I like would probably just be, Australia's had a lot of different movies that have come out that are low budget, just like, you know, we've had in North America, just like Europe, whatever. But the characters, the garb, like even if you look at the way that they dress, right? The police captains and even Toe Cutter, he's got a little shoulder pad on his left shoulder, right? And it seems like the guys that are higher up in rank have a little bit of a bigger shoulder pad, a hockey pad, and it progresses. And if you follow the series through, like, well, Mad Max has got this big old deal. So it's a status symbol. So there's nuances to the movie culture wise, you know, within their own storyline that unless you pay attention to it, you're not going to get into it. Like, what does that mean? Or even, you know, case in point, like Road Warrior with the humongous, you know, you've got this huge 6'5" 250 pound yoked out German guy with a .357, you know, what, you know, who's got a hockey mat. Like, what's his story? You know, George Miller doesn't have to, like, there's all these characters that don't have any backstory apart from Max. And we don't have to know.
Yeah.
Like how Michael Mann in his movies develops all these characters where a huge action guy, right? But he has all these characters built up and they're very complex. And you want to know more, but you don't get to know more. You get what you get, and that's what you have. And you appreciate that. And I think George Miller starts that in 1979 with a lot of these guys, and it progresses. So there's depth in that, and the nuances of that, I that's what I like.
Let's dive in. Let's start talking about likes, because I think we're there. We've been talking a lot about George Miller, so let's just break this guy down. This is a guy who, this is his first directorial feature film. He did two short films before this with a guy by the name of Byron Kennedy. And Byron Kennedy and George Miller created Mad Max. They wrote the plot with another screenwriter, but this is their baby. there's a little tragedy in that, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. But these two met in 1971, and then 8 years later, they created Mad Max. They funded this movie by themselves. George Miller, I don't know if you guys know this, but George Miller was an emergency room doctor before this, and that's how he funded this movie. And a lot of the things that he saw in the hospital pertaining to motorcycle accidents or car wrecks, he put that in the movie. So that is very unique. I mean, this is a guy who really held no bars. And the best part about it is this movie is an extremely violent movie, but it's really not. A lot of the violence is insinuated. He lets your imagination run wild. So let's talk. Who wants to talk more about George Miller? I can go on.
I'll go. yeah, he's not only with these movies and what I said earlier about him as an action director, he's a pretty unique director. A lot of his other credits are kids movies. You have the two Babe movies, Happy Feet, the Penguin,
for which he won an Oscar for.
Yeah. I didn't realize this, Witches of Eastwick.
Yeah.
And I was reading about that, and apparently it was a terrible production, and Jack Nicholson like took him under his wing and was like, look, how many extras do you need? You need 150 extras. You tell the production company you need 300. And so I was reading, and apparently he learned a ton of stuff from Jack Nicholson, and they became really good buddies. But like, he doesn't have a ton of movies to his credit. I know he's done quite a bit of television in between things, but what he has directed, like, might sound, you know, as an adult reflecting back, Babe is a fantastic kids movie. Like, it's just a quality movie. Mm-hmm. Happy Feet, he's just a great director. He really doesn't have, of the stuff that I've seen, a bad credit to his name.
And he was nominated for Babe for two awards. He was nominated for Best Picture because he produced Babe, and then he also wrote Babe, so he had a Best Original Screenplay nomination. So to that credit.
Yeah, there you go, man. I mean, so he's a jack of all trades. And it's interesting to me because there's no way I would have told you without looking it up that any of those credits I mentioned were his.
Yeah.
I knew him purely as the Mad Max guy. And then you see the other end of the spectrum. You're like, man, he's really good. He's just really talented guy. But I think it's really interesting how he took his real world experiences. And that's why that action's so good. You know, he saw the aftermath of it, and he's just applying his experience, and it makes it that much more effective.
Yeah, I agree. Ben, do you want to add anything about George Miller? I mean, we're going to be talking a little bit.
Yeah, so I was very curious to see where the next Tom Hardy movie was going to line up, because what I heard was that he had originally signed on for three total movies with George Miller. And, you know, I love them all, you know, got nothing better to say about it. And the last thing I'd seen was that he was going to take a pause and come back, and then he was going to do Furiosa. So what Jay was talking about in the sense that, you know, hey, he has all these other productions underneath his belt. Well, he wants to reset and do something different before he comes back to a project, which to me, you know, that's a breath of fresh air when you're an artist, when you're whatever your job may be, when you invest so much time and energy into any project, having a healthy reset, doing something else entirely different, letting your mind and your anxiety reset and coming back to it, you know, I think that's healthy. So you're going to have a fresh look on everything, especially when you've been making these movies for 40 years, you know? So I didn't realize, you know, Babe and Happy Feet. I didn't know who was involved in those projects. I mean, you go from Mad Max to Babe to Thunderdome to Happy Feet or whatever the timeline might be. That shows, you know, some breadth there that, you know, he can accomplish a kid's movie while at the same time doing a post-apocalyptic, ultra-violent film. That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. I didn't know the bit about Jack Nicholson either, but I hope that, you know, all the stuff in the world resumes to normal at some point, and he can get back to production and figure it out. Cause you know, Tom Hardy and Charlize Theron and all those other characters. I mean, they're great.
Yeah, I mean, that's another good thing. It's like, he is a good writer. You know, he has written every one of these Mad Max movies. He was a little detached from Beyond Thunderdome. We'll talk about that here in a second. But what I really like about his writing, and especially not just with Mad Max, but with the movie as a whole or the series as a whole, is that he is gradually showing society breakdown. And Ben, I believe you had mentioned that, but he is gradually showing a society on as it collapses. He has a quote that says that he envisioned Mad Max as a silent film with sound. And I think that really goes, it speaks volumes to what this movie actually is, because like Jay said, it is a lot of action. There's not a whole lot of talking, and the movie is pretty straightforward. I mean, we didn't really go in depth, and we pretty much hit all the plot points. This movie is driven by the action of the film. It is a classic tale of revenge and someone spiraling out of control to the point of insanity. So from there, I mean, society breakdown in this film, you still have some semblance of order. I mean, but what I like about that is how George Miller conveys that in that silent film style. You see the Hall of Justice, but the U in Justice is almost it's hanging by a thread. It's almost ready to drop.
Yeah.
You don't have to have any type of, you know, noise or talking to understand that this is a society on the verge of collapse.
Even if you look at so the Hall of Justice, right, the sign is collapsing and the U is bent. And then when you transition to inside the police department, I mean, the walls are cracked, the paint's falling down, you know, and this is Australia. The picture of the Queen is crooked. You know, everything is teetering. The whole structure is beginning to fall apart. It's still there, but it's cracking.
Yeah, I mean, and he does a great job of showing that, but not an in-your-face sort of way. It's very subtle. You know, we're just thinking we're watching a movie about revenge, but we're seeing a society on the verge of collapse. Jay, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I I like the subtlety about it. Because like you said, there's still semblance of society and structure. There's little things going on throughout the movie, radio broadcasts, news broadcasts, and you can hear just a little. They talk about gas shortages. There's signs on certain parts of the road, dangerous area ahead with a skull and crossbones on it. That was really, really cool to me and made. So this movie totally works as a standalone. 100%.
Oh yeah, for sure.
But like we've been saying, after seeing what the world becomes, the subtlety of seeing this fall apart, and we're going, oh my gosh, I know how much worse this is going to get. I know where this brink is and where it's going to go. And then there's the scene where the tow cutter gang's stealing fuel.
Yeah.
And it's just showing like some of their crime, but it's also playing into that narrative of the fuel shortage and what's causing the dystopia. And to me, that was just really cool. Just the little tiny hints and little things you saw in it that showed it was on the verge of dystopia, but not quite there like the future films. I really, really liked that.
Yeah. And then, you know, future films, you know, you have the breakdown of society here, and then you have, there is no society in the next one. It's almost like a nuclear holocaust, they say in the film. But it's all gang related. But then in the third movie, you see society start to spring up. You have Aunt Anthony, which is played by Tina Turner. You know, and then you see Fury Road, where it's cult. I mean, it is just crazy how his evolution, and these are movies that have been around for 40 years. I mean, this movie celebrated its American release in March of 1980. So 40 years ago, this movie came out. We'll talk about that when we talk about dislike. Because there's certain things that they did. But, I mean, he was an expert in writing the stages of how this dystopian society just takes over. Any other thoughts on that before we dive into how the movie was filmed?
I think we should just not forget Master Blaster and all of this.
Who run Bada Town? Okay, so I don't know if you guys know this, but George Miller has gone on record saying that this movie, when it started filming, okay, so this movie was made for $350,000. It went on to make $100 million. So this movie was extremely profitable. They literally, for this film, he called it guerrilla filmmaking. They would close down roads without letting anybody outside of Melbourne, Australia know. So they had, they were doing this stuff completely on the fly. They would walkie-talkies and said, hey, we got the road closed, let's film this scene. And like, it's some of the best work, you know? The very first scene they shot was when Johnny Boy was going after the phone on the overpass and he was struggling with the lock. They had to do that really quickly. That's why he looked like he was so frantic, because they weren't supposed to be there. That's what makes this movie so unique, is it's like they knew what they had to do to get in and out and get done. Some of these chase scenes are fantastic. You know, the angles in which they use with the cars and the camera, it's just mind-boggling. It got to the point where the government of Australia found out that they were filming, and they're like, yeah, we want to help. So that, I mean, you can kind of see that later or in different aspects of the movie, but, you know, God bless them for doing it like this, because it really lends itself to the film. Ben, do you want to talk about how, you know, the car chases, things like that, the aesthetic that was used?
Sure. I mean, you summed it up more or less. I mean, it's all very rapid. It's all very succinct. So if you're, I mean, you couldn't compare it to something these days like, you know, Fast and the Furious or whatnot, but you're dealing with something that came out before 1980 in Australia with a low budget on rural, like, highways and county roads, on motorcycles, on, you know, souped up V8s, doing this stuff with, I don't know the caliber of the stunt drivers, but it was highly aggressive, highly dangerous for the budget and the area that they were filming in. You summed it up more or less. I mean, for the time and the budget, like, yeah, it's fantastic.
That's crazy to go back and think about that, because
yeah,
see that, you just thought it was really expertly made, but they just went for it. Jay, any thoughts on how the movie was made and the aesthetics of it?
One thing I'll add, and this is also going to be a shared dislike for you and I, on the sound level, but the sound they used with the cars, the squealing of the tires, the engines, he really uses sound, almost like, a score in yeah. some senses. Like, he's able to build the tension with the sounds of the cars. And I thought, and that's pretty, like you said, that's still another element of that action, pushing that narrative forward, and just the way he uses sound in that regard. Like I said, we'll have a different complaint on some of the sound, but the way he uses it in the car chases, I think, is phenomenal. And you and I think we're on the we talked sound editing during the Oscars and stuff.
Ford and Ferrari,
right? Wow. Where do they get a lot of those sounds and
right.
and usage of sounds, man? Mad Max.
It's crazy. I mean, it's like he said, silent film with sound. And, you know, it's not even like the sound of like the whole film. You know, it's just the cars. Like, when the gunshots go off, it's not really emphasized, but the cars are emphasized. The crashing, the gearing of metal, it's so visceral, which really makes the movie so unique and expertly done. Yeah. I found out when I was doing my research too, that, Byron Kennedy, Joe Miller's business partner, they edited the movie by themselves. They did the sound, they did the score, they edited everything together in their apartment. So this is just crazy to think that these two guys started with nothing and literally just took off. Now, this is where I'm going to say, you know, the bummer thing is this will lead to our dislikes, unless any of you guys have anything else you want to talk about likes. No. Okay, so the bummer about this, and it's not so much so for this movie, but for future movies, is that Byron Kennedy, who worked with Miller on both of these, on both Mad Max and The Road Warrior, he was scouting for locations for Beyond Thunderdome, and he passed away. He died in a helicopter crash, I believe. I could be wrong, but George Miller was devastated. That is why there's another director credit on Beyond Thunderdome. And that's why Beyond Thunderdome feels very different. It really does. It's still a good movie, but it feels different because it doesn't really have that Byron Kennedy and George Miller feel to it. And George Miller has gone on interviews and said that he did this movie as a way to grieve, but it just didn't work out the way he wanted to. He knew that Kennedy wanted it done, but he was just in such a hot mess that he just could not do it. So that's why it's got a different feel, but we'll dive into that when we talk about sequels. So for Mad Max, it's very hard to pick out a dislike, but I'm going to let Jay take this one because we both had the same feel. I am lucky enough that when Scream Factory released their cut, they had the original, but Jay, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, my Blu-ray does not have the original dialogue, so it's all, all dubbed over, and, it's okay. it's distracting. Yeah. Like I said, there's not dialogue is used very minimally, but with intention. And the problem with the dubbing is it probably would have been easier to understand what they were saying without them dubbing it, because you're paying attention just like we do in real life. You know, we watch each other's mouths and you hear it, and then it's not lined up absolutely perfectly when they're talking, and it's a distraction because they're speaking the same language. You know, if they were speaking a different language, we expect it to not line up, but when they're speaking the same language, but just with an accent. That part is really distracting. Luckily when all the fantastic action sequences are happening, it's a non-issue because there's really not any dialogue involved. That's definitely my biggest gripe, was that dubbing. The other slight one, I do think just kind of in the middle of the movie, it is action packed, but there's a bit of a lull, as the story's moving forward for me. But not much. That's a really, really tiny complaint. The dubbing is my biggest complaint with the movie.
Yeah, I mean, and what of course we're referencing is this movie was filmed in Australia, and when it was released to the United States, they dubbed it over with English speaking people. So Mel Gibson, this is his career. This is his first feature film. We'll talk about that during the impact part. He was dubbed over, you know, so in Australia they say, "Oi," for hi. So in the American version, they say hi. It's not oi. And it was just extremely dubbed over. Like Jay said, I can only imagine that it was very distracting. But when Shout Factory released it for Blu-ray, they kept the original Australian actors' voices there. This is a very tiny little nitpicking thing for me about dislike, but it also goes into a like, is I wanted more of Toe Cutter, but it's one of those things where if you get more of it, it could be bad. You know, this guy, Byrne, really destroyed this movie. I mean, he hisses in it, and I read somewhere that every time he talks, he uses a different accent, and he does. It's crazy. And he's just such an imposing character and villain. He's not in it a whole lot, but that's a good thing. You know, but it's like, you want more. So do you risk the movie being affected by that? Or do you just let that little tiny thing go the wayside and be happy with what you got? Because Hugh Caine's Byrne, I mean, he really destroyed this movie. And I forgot to mention that likes, but that's why I brought it up or dislike, because I wanted more. But beggars can't be choosers, and who knows, if we got more, it could destroy the movie. Luckily, we did get more with Fury Road, but we'll talk about that more down the road. Ben, was there anything in Mad Max that you have as a dislike, or do you think the movie is perfect?
Well, I'll say that a crazy antagonist like Toe Cutter, because I noticed that too, he was having different accents, and you know, I was trying to figure out, like, well, we're in Australia, why are you sounding, you know, X, Y, and Z. And even though, you know, it's the relationship with the UK, whatever. I thought that was interesting because that made me focus on that character. So I thought that was actually kind of cool. in terms of dislikes, if you go back and, cause I did it in reverse order, you know, having watched Fury Road and then all the other ones in between, I wish I would have seen more information and they would have broadcast more about society and the breakdown. Like, how did they get to this point? And I know they talk about it in Road Warrior and it builds and it continues to build, which is fine. But where are we at now? Why are we here now? Talking about Mad Max and, you know, his descent into madness that comes up in all the other movies. And you mentioned that, you know, he was given a furlough. He went on a 2-week vacation to clear his head, and then everything spiraled out from there. But, how did they get to this point here? I wish there was just a little bit more development with the storyline to give more context, because we kind of just, we're already in third gear and the movie starts. Well, how do we get there? that would have been nice, but that's my really only major gripe.
Yeah.
Again, I had the opposite. I'm one of the few people, I love ambiguity in movies, and not everybody does. Absolutely. I love that. I'm like, what did get us here? And then my brain starts going, maybe this happened or that happened. And I'm a big fan of that, but that's not a thing for everybody. So I totally understand where you're coming from.
What's great is the fact that, you know, it allows us to draw these conclusions, because in the second film, Road Warrior, they do mention a nuclear holocaust, but we don't see that in the first movie. So, you know, is there war going on? Is that what's leading to this dystopian society, the breakdown of society? I mean, it's just so ambiguous. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, it can get under your skin, be like, well, why are we here? You know, we as movie watchers, we want all the answers, but I guess it's one of those things that's told over time. Anybody have anything else they want to share about dislikes before we move on to our next topic of discussion? All right, we're moving on. This movie was such a success. Again, $100 million worldwide. So it hold the Guinness Book of World Records for, best ratio from budget to earning. It was beaten in 99 by Blair Witch Project. This movie spawned 3 sequels. Mad Max, The Road Warrior, which came out in 82, 83, correct? Maybe. Could be wrong. And then you have Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, which was 85. I know that one because it was the year before I was born. And then you have Fury Road, which came out in 2015. I'm sorry. So Mad Max 2 was 81, and then Beyond Thunderdome was 85, and then Fury Road was 2015. Again, we've talked about the sequels. Let's talk about ranking. We do this whenever we talk about a movie that's part of a set. We rank the movies as a whole. This is a podcast episode where we're talking about Mad Max. So we're not going to dive into the other movies, even though we kind of hinted at it, which is fine. But I want to hear your guys' ranking of these movies. I'm going to go last because I'm the host and it's my choice. Ben, rank the 4 movies. Let's hear your rankings and why.
Normal order.
Yeah. 1, 2, 3, 4.
My ranking is skewed just because having seen Fury Road most recently, and then going back and watching Mad Max for the podcast, gave me new perspective on the appreciation of the storyline and the characters and how they got there. I like the normal, you know, progression of the storyline.
Okay. So we got 1, 2, 3, 4 in that order. Jay, go ahead.
mine is not in numerical order. I do think, though, this is probably the most successful series where just
so hard.
Everyone is so good. I got to go with Fury Road as my favorite. And then I would go Road Warrior. And what's awesome to me is before Fury Road came out, Road Warrior usually ranked in the top, 2 or 3 of every best action movies ever lists. And then Fury Road just blew it out of the water somehow. It was amazing. So Fury Road, Road Warrior, then I got to go with Thunderdome. And I had actually put the original last, and I don't mean that it's bad. I just think for entertainment's sake, that's my order. I will say with Thunderdome, because we did have a discussion on this one before, there may be some of that that nostalgia you were talking about earlier that guides my thinking of it. I definitely watched, just like you did, Ben, this one a lot on TNT or TBS, whatever it was when it was on TV all the time. So I have a spot in my heart for watching that when I was younger. But there's just some, I quote Thunderdome very frequently. So it's gotta be. So Fury Road, Road Warrior, Thunderdome, and then Mad Max. That's my
Did you
order.
Dress up as Master Blaster for Halloween?
Is that a short joke?
Yes. you know, okay. So I have to look at these movies as a series. And in doing so, I have to put Fury Road at the top. And the reason why I do that is because it's like Miller at the top of his game. You know, if he had that type and that level of ability to show that type of production, and if Byron Kennedy was there and this Fury Road came out in 80, think about the movie we would have gotten in 2015. I mean, the level of ingenuity these guys have. I mean, they had practical effects just in Mad Max alone, because that's what they had, you know? And then when you're given a bigger budget, look at the scale of that movie. Fury Road was nominated for, I believe 10 Oscars, and it took home 6, and they were all technical awards. And that was a really hard year. But I really wish that George Miller would have won Best Director. I wish it would have won Best Picture, but it didn't. It lost to The Revenant for Best Director, and it lost to Revenant for cinematography, which was also fantastic. Spotlight won Best Picture, which, you know, Tomato Tomato, both great films. But I mean, it really irks me that movie, because it just was so technical, and it won the most awards that year. 2015, it took home 6 Oscars, the most out of any movie, because it was technically flawless. It was a brilliant film. I could talk for days. This is a podcast about Mad Max. My number 2 is Mad Max, because without Mad Max, there would be nothing else. So it's almost like bookending. You have what we're given and the awe that movie Fury Road gave us. And then you have the subtlety in which it was introduced. And we would not have Fury Road if we did not have Mad Max. And then you have Road Warrior, you know, almost interchangeable between 1 and or 2 and 3. But Road Warrior is after Mad Max. And then, of course, as much as I love Beyond Thunderdome and the nostalgia and seeing it on TNT and, you know, everything about that movie, whether it's Master Blaster, the pygmy kids, you know, the quicksand that, you know, affected us as kids, whether it was the Princess Bride or, you know, the Never Ending Story, quicksand was always the fear. It just does not hold up, and it's not George Miller at his finest. He was grieving. You can see it in the film. It's just a flawed movie. But then when you have the studio saying, hey, let's make it PG-13, more problems, because these movies are ultra violent. If you looked at Mad Max, when he gets shot in the leg, when he's having the confrontation between Bubba before he shoots Bubba, like, that is a gnarly wound. And remember, George Miller was a doctor. So he's like, this is what a gunshot to the knee would look like. And it's perfect almost. So that is my ranking. You know, we all have our opinions, so leave it as it is. Let's talk impact, because this movie has such an impact on the world of cinema. This movie was released 40 years ago, and the biggest impact of all, whether you think he's crazy or not, it made Mel Gibson a star. He went into an audition because his sister was auditioning. He apparently, there's rumors to the story, but he was in a bar fight the night before. So he showed up the next with his sister to the audition, and he was all beat to you know what. And George Miller was like, okay, let's hear from this guy. And he won the role. But without Mad Max, would we have been given a Mel Gibson? Would we have been given, you know, whether it be Lethal Weapon, you know, Forever Young, Man Without a Face, The Passion of the Christ? Would we have been given a Mel Gibson if it wasn't for this movie? And that leaves a lot to be said. But any guys' thoughts on, you know, Mel Gibson and his rise to stardom with this film?
I don't think it's shocking. I think he was very good in it. It isn't, you know.
But it solidifies him as an action star.
Yeah. He's got the look. He's got the build. And it solidified him as, like, the go-to revenge actor.
Yeah. He was in a movie called Payback.
He plays an offshoot in Lethal Weapon. Man, I think that's kind of an offshoot of Mad Max as a detective modern-day version, not in a dystopia. So I think he did get a little typecast for a while with it, but it's not shocking. Like I said, he had the look, he had the build. He showed his chops in this movie, and when he went mad, you believed it.
Yeah. Ben, any thoughts on Mel Gibson and the impact that Mad Max had for his career?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure of the exact dates, but after Mad Max, I think he did at least one Lethal Weapon movie, and then maybe two, and then there was Thunderdome. So he was already solidified at that point. And you talk about the grieving of George Miller and everything else, but I feel like there had been notoriety at that point around Mel Gibson, and then the projects with George Miller, and then Thunderdome occurred, and then, you know, now we're talking 80s. Well, Tina Turner gets involved, so everything is put up way on a pedestal. So, you know, they were projecting him into the forefront for sure. So by that time, I mean, he was already a star. So let's monopolize on it and talk about the ratio of a $350,000 budget to a $100 million take home. You know, I think Western Hollywood's saying, okay, let's put some time into it.
Good. That's the perfect way to put it. I mean, is there anything else that you guys want to talk about that the impact that Mad Max had in the film world? I mean, one thing that I know is that it really opened up Australian cinema. I mean, Gallipoli was released right after that. Gallipoli also stars Mel Gibson, but you see a lot more Australian films hitting the worldwide market. But that's just society. I mean, movies in and of itself, I mean, you have Saw, which James Wan and Lee Wenthal, they both said that Mad Max, that scene with him cutting his, you know, giving him the option, that led them to think about Saw. I mean, it's just the impact of the film is just, you know, 40 years later, it still has a huge impact on film. Jay, you have anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, it's the standard bearer of dystopian films.
Agreed. Yes.
Every dystopian film at some level takes something from the Mad Max series. Outfits is a big one, and they fail too most of the time compared to Mad Max. The dynamic, I mean, every dystopian film is, it tries to be some version. I think I shouldn't say every, but a lot of dystopian films try to be some version of Mad Max. And the problem is they don't know the magic that makes it happen. And part of that is George Miller has a vision, and this is a world he wants, not some world that he's basing off of something else. But I can't think of too many dystopian films where there's not at least some element taken from the series.
Agree with you 100%. This movie definitely set the bar for future dystopian apocalyptic movies, because there's always something to draw from, whether it's Mad Max or Road Warrior, Thunderdome, you name it. Ben, you want to add anything to that?
Sure. I just like to see a crossover between Mad Max and Crocodile Dundee.
Another Australian movie.
I just want to see some, you know, I just want to see the lines intersect, and, you know, they help some people out and then they part ways, you know, maybe 5-10 minutes tops, you know, but I just want to see that occur. Maybe Miller will give that to us. Maybe not.
You know, I'm going to wrap it up here by saying, unless anybody else has got anything else to say, what really drew me to have this be our May flashback is, you know, given the world's current state of unrest with the pandemic, you know, there are memes being created because of Mad Max. You guys can't see because we don't have video, but I'm going to show the guys that, because they can see on the camera. This literally says, so do we start dressing like this immediately, or is there a specific amount of time that needs to pass? And it's two pictures from the Road Warrior. You've got Humongous in his S&M, you know, leather bikini with his hockey mask. You've got a guy in shoulder pads with feathers, you know, and it's just a joke that they're saying. And that was because of the Road Warrior, which was released 2 years after Mad Max. Again, Mad Max doesn't necessarily dive deep into that type of dress because we're still in society before that complete and utter breakdown. So legacy aside, this movie is still going further. George Miller is in contract talks to continue. You know, this movie did great at the 2015 Oscars. So Warner Brothers should just give George Miller the money that he wants and let him do what he wants, because he did the same thing with practical effects for Fury Road with what he did with Mad Max. So give him more money and let's see what he can do. He even said when he wrote Fury Road, he had two more Mad Max tales, and then he did the spinoff for Furiosa, which was Charlize Theron's character in Fury Road. But the next Mad Max movie we are waiting for is Mad Max The Wasteland. But this movie has been referenced in comedies. I mean, it has implications in other actions. I mean, it even has a PS4 video game. So the impact is just crazy. Any last thoughts when it comes to Mad Max, guys, before we wrap it up?
I might be crazy, but I think there was a Nintendo game too.
I very well could. I don't know. I just remember the PS4 game of late. Well,
no, it's a great series, long lasting impact. One of my favorites, and I hope that with Fury Road coming out, it pushes more filmmakers to do practical effects with, and I'm cool with special effects and CGI, because he used it, but he used it very well with practical effects, and it was just to stunning and shockingly good levels that he used it. So it's one of the all-time great action series, period.
Agreed. Well, that's going to do it for us for here at Flashbacks. Thank you for going down this nostalgia trip down to the dystopian society of Mad Max with me tonight. Well, wait, before I do that. Plug time. You can visit us at the Front Row Network at thefrnpod.com. You can also check us out on Facebook and Twitter, the Front Row Network. We have Bad Boys coming up for our June flashback. Jay's going to be on that because he's our new co-host. So that is going to wrap up for us. I had to do our shameless plug, so I apologize. With me tonight, down our road to nostalgia, has been...
Thank you. Thank you much.
So you gotta say
I got nothing to plug.
You got to say your name.
Ben Weir.
And our new flashback co-host,
Jay Hoffman.
Thank you very much for joining us, and we will see you in the front row.
This episode is a production of the Front Row Network, a proud Community Voices member of National Public Radio, Illinois. For more information and to see the full slate of Front Row Network shows, you can visit frnpod.com or nprillinois.org. You can also find and follow us on social media by searching for the Front Row Network on Facebook and Instagram, and Front Row Reviews with a Z on Twitter.